From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Under these circumstances, it's hard to understand how derivative traders at AIG warranted any bonuses, much less $165 million in extra pay.
As the rage around AIG bonuses continues to grow, underscoring again the question, who benefits in an economic meltdown? We look at who's hurt the worst, communities of color around the country. Then this week marks the 6th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. We'll talk to Professor Juan Cole about his new book, Engaging the Muslim World. And former President George W. Bush is traveling to Canada today for his first trip abroad since leaving the White House. We'll speak with Lawyers Against the War. They say Bush should be either barred or detained for condoning the use of torture at overseas jails. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Facing increasing public outcry, the Obama administration pledged Monday to try to block the bailed-out insurance giant AIG from paying out as much as $450 million in bonuses to top executives and other employees. AIG is attempting to hand out the bonuses despite the company's central role in the meltdown of the global economy. AIG has already received $173 billion in government bailouts. During the last quarter of 2008, AIG lost a record $62 billion. That amounts to over $460,000 per minute. On Sunday's TV shows, Lawrence Summers, one of the president's top economic advisors, said the government cannot just abrogate contracts. But yesterday, President Barack Obama asked Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner to pursue every legal avenue to block the bonuses.
This is a corporation that finds itself in financial distress due to recklessness and greed. Under these circumstances, it's hard to understand how derivative traders at AIG warranted any bonuses, much less $165 million in extra pay. I mean, how do they justify this outrage to the taxpayers who are keeping the company afloat?
AIG has so far refused to publicly reveal who is set to receive the money. On Monday, New York State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo issued a subpoena to uncover this information and to determine if the bonuses are legal. Cuomo said if a company enters into contracts in which it agrees to pay funds it effectively doesn't have, it's akin to a looting of a company. While Cuomo's issuing subpoenas, Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa suggested the top executives at AIG should consider taking their own lives. Grassley said, quote, the first thing that would make me feel a little bit better towards them if they'd follow the Japanese model and come before the American people and take that deep bow and say, I'm sorry, and then either do one of two things, resign or go commit suicide. A new Treasury report has found the nation's largest banks are continuing to reduce the flow of credit to new homeowners and consumers despite receiving hundreds of billions of dollars in taxpayer bailouts. In December, the nation's 21 largest banks lent out $162 billion for first mortgages. Less than half that amount was lent out in January. New home equity credit lines decreased from $15 billion to just $5 billion. Hospital officials in Israel say the American activist Tristan Anderson is now semi-conscious after days under full anesthesia. Anderson was critically injured Friday when Israeli soldiers fired a tear gas canister directly at his head during a weekly nonviolent protest against the separation wall in the West Bank village of Nalin. Anderson underwent brain surgery in an Israeli hospital near Tel Aviv Saturday. Parts of his right frontal lobe were removed. Anderson is now able to lift fingers on one hand in response to a voice command. Meanwhile, friends and supporters of Tristan Anderson held a series of protests Monday. In San Francisco, hundreds of people marched to the Israeli consulate. Police arrested five activists at the scene. Three protesters were arrested at a demonstration outside the Israeli consulate in Miami, Florida. A group of 16 of the world's leading war crimes investigators and judges have sent a letter to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon calling for the United Nations to launch a full inquiry into war crimes committed during Israel's attack on Gaza. The letter's signatories include Archbishop Desmond Tutu and former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Mary Robinson. According to the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, 1,434 Palestinians were killed in the Israeli assault, including 960 civilians. 13 Israelis died in the war, including 3 civilians killed by Hamas rockets. In Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu has formed a pact with far-right politician Avigdor Lieberman in an attempt to forge a right-wing government in which Lieberman would become Israel's foreign minister. Lieberman has called for laws to require Palestinians living in Israel to swear loyalty to the Jewish state or lose their citizenship. Lieberman has been condemned by many moderate Israeli and Jewish leaders. Rabbi Eric Yaffe, president of the Union for Reform Judaism, recently described Lieberman's run for president as a, quote, outrageous, abominable, hate-filled campaign brimming with incitement that, if left unchecked, could lead Israel to the gates of hell, unquote. This is Ahmed Tibi, one of the few Palestinians in the Israeli Knesset.
This is the compatible of Le Pen and Jörg Haider. When those were elected, the Austrian government was isolated and boycotted mainly by Israel. It is time to call for boycotting the government and mainly boycotting Lieberman himself.
Back in the United States, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer is printing its final edition today and becoming an online-only news site known as SeattlePI.com. The 146-year-old newspaper will become the largest daily newspaper to shift to an entirely digital news product. The paper's owner, the Hearst Corporation, made the official announcement on Monday. The vast majority of the paper's 167 employees are losing their jobs in the transition. The closing of the PI comes just days after Gannett announced the closing of the Tucson Citizen. Last month, Scripps closed the Rocky Mountain News. Many media analysts say the San Francisco Chronicle may be the next paper to cease publication. On Monday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urged the Justice Department to consider giving Bay Area papers more leeway to merge or consolidate business operations to stay afloat. Health officials in Washington, D.C. say 3% of the city's population now has HIV or AIDS. Shannon Hader, director of the district's HIV/AIDS administration, said, quote, our rates are higher than West Africa. They're on par with Uganda and some parts of Kenya. Hader said the HIV rates in Washington are twice as high as New York City and 5 times as high as Detroit. A campaign has been launched to disbar former Pentagon attorney William Haynes for his role in approving the Bush administration's torture policies. The National Lawyers Guild has filed a complaint with the California State Bar against Haynes. The complaint states Haynes, quote, breached his duty as a lawyer and advocated for harsh tactics amounting to torture in violation of U.S. and international law. Unlike several other top Bush administration attorneys, Haynes was able to find a job after leaving office. He's now chief corporate counsel at the oil giant Chevron. The New York Times recently reported former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez and Dick Cheney's former chief of staff David Addington are both still looking for work. In Iran, the former president, Mohammad Khatami, has withdrawn his candidacy from the country's June presidential election. Khatami said he didn't want to split the reformist vote. He made the announcement days after another pro-reform candidate, the former Iranian prime minister, Meir Hossein Mousavi, announced his candidacy. The BBC reports Khatami's withdrawal leaves Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in a stronger position to win re-election. In news from Iraq, the U.S. military has revealed U.S. jets shot down an Iranian unmanned surveillance aircraft last month. The incident took place in Iraq, about 60 miles northeast of Baghdad. Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir said Monday he wants all foreign aid groups to leave Sudan within a year. Al-Bashir accused the aid groups of providing false testimony against him and his government. The move comes less than 2 weeks after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for al-Bashir on charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Sudan's Darfur region. John Holmes, the UN Emergency Relief Coordinator, said the aid groups need to stay in Sudan.
If all the agencies were required to leave and not be able to operate, that would, we believe, have enormous ramifications for the welfare of people in Darfur and elsewhere in Sudan. The government of South Sudan, for example, have made clear that they welcome international NGOs continuing to work in the south and indeed in the border areas. So it would have a very significant impact if it was carried out in quite the way in which that statement appears to suggest. As I say, we've only seen media reports of that, and we've had no clarification about what it's supposed to mean.
The U.S. government's now holding a record number of immigrants in jail. A new report by the Associated Press found 32,000 immigrants are being held as of January, nearly five times the number held in 1994. According to the Associated Press, 58% of the immigration prisoners do not have an attorney. President Obama's vow to fundamentally change how the nation handles food safety issues, saying the current system is a, quote, hazard to public health. On Saturday, Obama announced the creation of a food safety working group to advise him on which laws and regulations need to be changed.
This working group will bring together cabinet secretaries and senior officials to advise me on how we can upgrade our food safety laws for the 21st century, foster coordination throughout our government, and ensure that we are not just designing laws that will keep the American people safe, but enforcing them.
President Obama's also nominated Margaret Hamburg, former New York City Health Commissioner, to be Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. Meanwhile, First Lady Michelle Obama's been touting the benefits of locally grown food and community gardens. In a speech last month, the First Lady described herself as a big believer in community gardens. In a separate interview, she said, quote, "When you grow something yourself and it's close and it's local, oftentimes it tastes really good." In an attempt to support local farmers, the White House has begun buying fresh fruits and vegetables from farms in Maryland, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Sarah Jane Olson is set to be released today from a California prison. She was a member of the Symbionese Liberation Army in the 1970s. She was arrested in 1999 after living for 25 years underground under a different name. She pleaded guilty to taking part in two attempts to bomb the Los Angeles Police Department in 1975, but later proclaimed her innocence. And the civil rights activist Richard Aoki has died at the age of 71. He was an early member of the Black Panther Party and later served as a field marshal for the Panthers. He was the only Asian American to hold a leadership role in the group. Aoki was born in 1938 in California and spent part of his childhood living in an internment camp during World War II. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, AIG said it would pay $450 million in bonuses despite receiving a $173 billion bailout that's given the U.S. government an 80% stake. On Monday, the Treasury said it would withhold $165 million from the next installment of AIG's taxpayer money. The AIG controversy is the latest to exemplify the near unfettered flow of government money to corporations that helped cause the financial crisis. As AIG uses the bailout to hand out bonuses, a new report says people of color continue to bear the heaviest burden in the current economic recession. According to the Center for Social Inclusion, communities of color continue to be disproportionately deprived of infrastructure spending, job creation, and other key government services. The report's author calls for the government to use some of the billions in federal stimulus money to focus on the needs of communities of color. The report's called One Region, Promoting Prosperity Across Race. Mayotte Wiley is the director of the Center for Social Inclusion, joining us here in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you focused on New York, but see that as a microcosm of the country.
That's right. We focused on the New York metropolitan region, so that includes parts of Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, Westchester County, Long Island. And the reason we did was twofold. One, obviously, New York is a huge region of the country. And increasingly in this country, we have to look at regions in terms of how we build opportunity, because our jobs flow, our economies flow, and our people flow across our political boundaries of cities and suburbs. But it's also critically important because if we look at the leadership in Washington right now, the New York delegation actually has an incredibly important leadership role to play. So if we can figure out how we implement some of these policies well in the New York region, hopefully we can become a model for how to do this well across the country.
So what are your chief findings? How have communities of color been hardest hit, and what are the models to bring them out of the global economic meltdown?
Well, I want to step back for a minute because I think there's one part of this meltdown story that is not getting told enough, although some people are starting to tell it. I mean, obviously, everyone knows that we started in this crisis with a mortgage crisis. Well, 35% of subprime mortgage holders were actually eligible for prime rate loans. 35%. So imagine if we had had a financing system where people actually fairly got the loans that they should get. Most of those were people of color. And even when you look at the expansion of the subprime industry, a lot of it was around the fact that communities of color didn't have fair access to credit. So we're in this mess in part because we didn't look at the warning signs. The warning signs for our economy were in communities of color. We tend to be first hit first and hit hardest. So as we look at, of course, how this crisis has played out, it's played out across jobs. People are losing jobs. People are in danger of losing their homes, not just if they're homeowners, but also if they're renters, because the developers who own buildings are going into foreclosure and those rentals are in danger. But, you know, what we really see is that we have to stimulate equality in order to stimulate the economy. And we have to do that nationally. So if we look at the parts of the country, the communities that are most impacted, that have the lowest opportunity, and we think about how we direct investments there, there's a lot of good social science that shows that we can build regional economies that way.
Following up on saying what proportion of the people got subprime were eligible for prime, the NAACP has just sued the subsidiaries of Wells Fargo and HSBC for allegedly steering African-American borrowers into subprime mortgages, NAACP saying the banks are were guilty of systematic institutionalized racism.
Yeah, and I think it's important that we look at that very closely. And the NAACP's leadership on that is very important. I mean, one of the things that we can do now, though, I mean, I think we have opportunities. We have an administration in Washington that's actually starting to try to get money into the economy. It's done that by looking at ways to get money into the hands of people who need it in some important ways, from, you know, increasing Medicaid access, also looking at expanding unemployment insurance, food stamps. Those are all very important things to do. But we have to think about implementation. Those policies, for example, in New York, and this is also a problem nationally, we tend to have people who are eligible for those programs who don't even know they're eligible. Back in the summer, there was an important study that showed that in Brooklyn alone, 200,000 people were eligible for food stamps and not getting them. So that's part of the story. But the other is we're going to stimulate jobs through the recent stimulus act, through construction, right? I mean, a big part of that is shovel-ready, projects that are ready to start digging in order to get those construction jobs going, to get people working, to get money flowing into the economy. Well, blacks and women of all races are deeply underrepresented in the construction trades. So if we're stimulating those jobs, we're not actually stimulating jobs for the communities that have the highest unemployment rates, unless we learn from some of the lessons of cities like Los Angeles, where both the city and the unions really took leadership in making sure that they got tracked people of color, women, into apprenticeship programs so that when those construction contracts came, there were real community benefits. That's a model that's very important, and our implementers, our public officials that are going to be looking at stimulus implementation, should also be taking the leadership to demand, for example, that 30% of the jobs that are part of the construction jobs that are stimulated go to people who are living at poverty level at the time that they're hired.
I'm always amazed when we hear unemployment numbers. They say they could hit double digits when the unemployment figures for African Americans that are over 12.6% in some communities, young black men at 50%.
Correct. If you look at the demographic, particularly for black and Latino males between the ages of 18 and 25, those statistics can get as high as 50% in some communities. And I think nationally it's in the high 20s. So we're talking about communities where you literally have no economy that is supporting those communities.
What about examples from the past in other cities like Houston coming out of global meltdowns?
Yeah. I mean, it's critically important to say that we do have some models that have worked. I mean, I'm focusing a lot on Los Angeles, also San Francisco, Houston, places that have really recognized that they have to build equitably and invest in people. So taking the leadership to say, how are we going to partner with unions to make sure that people get jobs? How are we going to ensure that some of the discretionary resources we have go to transit projects that are going to recognize where people are transit starved and how we're going to connect those people to job centers? Because our jobs are increasingly across regions. They're not just in our local communities. So people have to have a way to travel. You know, in the New York metropolitan area between 1935 and 2000, I think we added 1,600 miles of highway. Well, not only is that bad for the environment, low-income people, particularly people of color, don't have cars. So that doesn't provide a transportation system that ensures that people can connect to the jobs where they are.
What do you think is the most important issue you want people to take away from this discussion in terms of where we go from here right now when the stimulus plans are being made?
I think that the two most obvious, there are many, but the two most obvious are we must have community benefits agreements for construction jobs. We must ensure that when the government has construction contracts, it ensures that low-income people, people of color, women, are going to have their fair share of those jobs. And we must ensure that the way transit dollars, transportation dollars get spent, go to transit and really go to the smart projects that are going to connect people who need jobs to places where there are jobs.
Maya Wiley, I want to thank you for being with us. A report from the Center for Social Inclusion. We'll link to that report on our website at democracynow.org. This is Democracy Now! We'll be back with Juan Cole in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It's been nearly 2 months since President Obama took his oath of office to become the 44th president of the United States. In the early stages of the campaign, Obama swept through the primaries, then into the presidency on the basis of his anti-war message. Has he lived up to the promise? This week marks the 6th anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. To mark the occasion, protests and marches are being called across the country to urge President Obama to speed up the withdrawal of U.S. troops. Under Obama's plan, troop withdrawals won't begin until the end of 2009. Up to 50,000 U.S. troops would remain in Iraq through 2011. Obama's also not addressed whether the U.S. will keep permanent military bases in Iraq and has made no promises to withdraw the over 100,000 private U.S. military contractors and mercenaries stationed in Iraq. In Afghanistan, the Obama administration ordered 17,000 more U.S. troops to be deployed to fight as part of an escalation of the seven-year-old war. This comes as public support in many NATO countries for the continued occupation of Afghanistan is eroding. In Pakistan, the Obama administration's expanded the covert war run by the CIA and continues to carry out controversial drone attacks inside the country that have killed scores of civilians. In Iran, Obama's extended a section of U.S. sanctions for at least another year. The restrictions bar U.S. companies from involvement in the Iranian oil industry and blocking trade and investment ties. In Israel and the occupied territories, the Obama administration's continued the U.S. government's unwavering support for Israel. The administration recently announced it'll withdraw its entire $900 million aid pledge if the pending Palestinian Unity government does not recognize Israel's right to exist. No such conditions have been imposed on Israel. This comes in the wake of Israel's brutal three-week assault on Gaza that left over 1,400 Palestinians dead, more than 900 of them civilians. Well, Juan Cole is a longtime analyst of U.S. Mideast affairs, a professor of history at University of Michigan. His blogged and forum comment receives 250,000 unique hits every month. He's just written a new book. It's out today. It's called Engaging the Muslim World. Juan Cole joins us here in our Firehouse studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you so much, Amy.
It's nice to have you here in the studio as opposed to talking you out in Michigan. But let's start off with, well, this is the week of the sixth anniversary of Iraq. What's your assessment of where we stand, where Iraq stands?
Well, Iraq is starting to see, finally, some fairly good news. I think it's important that the government seems to be starting to be more responsive, that the prime minister has established more security in cities like Basra or Amara. And you can see this in the results of the provincial elections, where the prime minister's party did exceptionally well, I think, in those places where he had sent in troops and established more order. And so this is a change. From a year ago, I wouldn't be talking like this. It really is a better situation in some ways. But, of course, there are so many problems. There are 4 million people who have been left essentially homeless, displaced, 2.7 million inside the country, another very large number in Jordan and Syria. There are still very severe tensions between the Arab community and the Kurdish community over the northern oil city of Kirkuk and other territory in the north. That issue has not been resolved by any means. And so the country faces many problems of infrastructure. There's not enough potable water available to people. There's very high rates of unemployment. There's not much foreign investment in most of the country outside the Kurdistan region. So it is a basket case. I mean, it is a mess, but there are some slight signs of some improvement
and
recently.
And the 50,000 troops that Obama says will stay through 2011, 100,000 private contractors.
Sure. Well, you know, for me, the issue is not so much the rate at which the United States withdraws from Iraq. I believe President Obama when he says he is committed to bringing the U.S. troops out. And I think the Marines, the infantry, are going to gradually be brought out almost entirely. But the question is, what do they leave behind? And, you know, if you had a civil war breakout between the Arabs and the Kurds over Kirkuk, could bring in Turkey, could bring in Iran, could destabilize the whole Eastern Mediterranean, would have implications for the world economy, the U.S. could get drawn back in. So I think the important thing is that Obama, before he leaves, makes some political arrangements, does some heavy-duty diplomacy with local people, tries to get some covenants amongst the groups about who gets what as he goes out.
So would you say the surge worked?
No. I take nothing away from the U.S. military. I think they tried to do their best. Tamping down the really apocalyptic rates of violence that were there in places like Baghdad in early 2007. But I think the main reason for which the rate of civilian death has fallen dramatically in the past year and a half has been because the ethnic cleansing campaign of the Shiite militias against the Sunni Arab population of Baghdad succeeded. And the recent provincial elections indicate to me that Baghdad may be as little as 10 or 15% Sunni now. It used to be 50-50 before the Americans came. So there aren't any Sunnis around in most Shiite neighborhoods anymore to be killed.
Juan Cole, the first chapter of your book, The Struggle for Islamic Oil, The Truth About Energy Independence. What is the truth?
Well, I like President Obama a lot, and I'm very green. I'm all in favor of alternative energies, but the physical limitations are there, and the likelihood is by 2050, we still will get probably a majority of our energy from hydrocarbons. This is undesirable, but there are severe limitations to what can be done. So the deep reserves of hydrocarbons, oil and gas, are in the Persian Gulf and Central Asia. So over time, as the shallower reserves are used, or people start using their own oil, as we expect to happen in Mexico, the United States is going to be actually much more dependent on hydrocarbons in the Muslim world than it is now.
And what is that going to mean for each country?
Well, we'd better have good relations with them. I say find a Muslim, make a friend. The Venezuelans now are starting to try to make a pipeline to the Pacific so as to export more to China, because they want to diversify away from the United States because they have such bad political relations with the U.S. If we have bad political relations with the countries of the Muslim world that are producing the hydrocarbons, you know, increasingly it's a seller's market. They could sell it to China or India instead, and the United States could end up really not having the energy that it needs.
Let's talk about Afghanistan. The U.S. pushing a surge there. At this moment, 17,000 more soldiers in Afghanistan. Vice President Joe Biden goes to Brussels to meet with NATO. NATO countries, increasingly opposed to the Afghan war. But the U.S. is pushing harder and trying to get support in countries that don't want to support it, like Canada, like Britain.
Well, Canada has announced that it's leaving in 2012, and a lot of the European publics are very much opposed to a continued military mission in Afghanistan. Afghanistan is an almost insoluble problem, and the question is, what's the mission? You know, if you're sending U.S. troops there to fight, to die, we have to know what is exactly their mission, and it's not to fight al-Qaeda. Have you seen anything for the last 5 years in the newspapers about U.S. troops capturing major al-Qaeda figures in Afghanistan, even fighting al-Qaeda units? I don't see any evidence that they're there. So what we're fighting is Pushtuns, the neo-Taliban, which is a...
What probably, do you mean, the neo-Taliban?
Well, you know, the Taliban were the old Mullah Omar group that now is based in Quetta. They're still active. But there are new groups that have emerged, some of them old warlords. Gulbuddin Hikmet Yar, who is, I talk about this in the book. This is a former U.S. ally, a very hardline a fundamentalist who got the a lion's share of the CIA money that was given to fight the Soviets in the 1980s. He has now hooked up with Mullah Omar. He used to be an enemy of his. And his group, the Hizb-e-Islami, is actively fighting U.S. troops in the Pashtun regions. Or you have someone like Jalaluddin Haqqani, who's likewise an old warlord, who's now his group is considered part of the Taliban. And I think you have a lot of disgruntled villagers whose, you know, poppy crops were burned, or who don't want U.S. or NATO troops in their region, who are attacking checkpoints and soldiers, and who are also getting called Taliban. So you've got a complex group of insurgents, several thousand of them, who are challenging the Karzai government. And it seems to me that mainly what the U.S., Britain, and Australia are doing in the south of the country is to shore up the government of Hamid Karzai. And if that's the goal, that's a tough mission. Karzai only controls 30% of the country. The gross domestic product of Afghanistan is only $9 billion a year. There simply aren't the resources there to have a strong state, strong army. And if that is the goal, it's going to take a long time.
Do you have any sense that the goal of the Obama administration is to shore up Karzai? I mean, Biden was having dinner with him and walked out on him.
Yeah. Well, you know, Karzai is not the issue. It's the government in Kabul. And there are going to be elections in August, which I think Obama and Biden hope Karzai will lose. But the point is to shore up the elected government that was the product of the bond process. And it obviously just isn't that powerful a government. It doesn't control very much of the country. And but I think that is. The reason that we're there is to fight their enemies.
You wrote a piece, Juan Cole, called Obama's Vietnam, talking about Afghanistan. Explain.
Well, you know, Lyndon Johnson was bequeathed this police action in Vietnam, and he became very invested in it. You and I remember those days. And it was, again, you know, it was to shore up the South Vietnamese government, and we kept putting in troops, and you ended up with 500,000 over there. You know, they did search and destroy tactics, which alienated the population, and they didn't realize they were fighting a kind of nationalism. So I think in the same way, you know, there's a danger of Obama committing so many resources to Afghanistan in the wrong way. That it can turn into a major quagmire. And then just today, a poll came out that 40% of Americans now are thinking this was a mistake.
So what do you think Obama should be doing here? The same as Iraq, pulling out?
Well, again, I'm not so worried about the timetable for withdrawals. I'm worried about what they leave behind. So, you know, 80% of all insurgencies in modern history have been settled through negotiations of various sorts. Obviously, the people of the south of Afghanistan, there are substantial numbers of them who are not happy with the new situation. So, you know, Obama is a community organizer. What do you do as a community organizer? You go in, you ask people, what do you need? Why are you unhappy? What can we get for you? So he needs to do that with the Pashtuns. He needs to find out what they want and to see if there is not a peaceful way of getting it for them. And I think it's hard to say these things at a time when the U.S. economy is so badly damaged. But a very substantial foreign aid is needed to rebuild Afghanistan.
You mentioned the Taliban now focused in Quetta in Pakistan. What about Pakistan today? Yeah, just major march. Nawaz Sharif was going to be under house arrest. They surround his house with cars to keep him in, buses, trucks with the deflated tires. He gets out. He's going to lead a march. And they end up reinstating the Chief Justice.
Yes. Well, I have a chapter in the book that gives a lot of the background for that struggle between the Muslim League and the Pakistan People's Party. That kind of party politics and rivalry is not new in Pakistan.
Muslim League being Nawaz Sharif, People's Party.
The Muslim League and the branch of the Muslim League that follows Nawaz Sharif.
People's Party being the current president.
It's a kind of, the People's Party is kind of left of center, the Muslim League kind of right of center. Well, there's party politics and street politics. I actually think it's fairly healthy what happened. The president overreached and the people of Punjab let him know that he overreached. And that's much better than, you know, under a military dictatorship like Musharraf. Things were quiet, but underneath there was all this turmoil. And that's a different kind of issue than the issue that's faced in the tribal regions of the northwest of the country. That's the one I think the Obama administration is really concerned about, because you have cross-border raids into Afghanistan, you have safe harbor for militants. And that's another really tough nut to crack, because that region, as you know, is very craggy. It's like our southwest. And 30% of it is considered by the Pakistani government to be administratively inaccessible. So I don't think that it's going to be very easy for them to control that region.
And the unmanned drone attacks that are killing increasing number of civilians that are, well, coming out of the United States, CIA-backed.
Right. Well, what the Obama administration maintains is that they are killing Arab Afghans. They're killing volunteers who have come from places like Egypt and so forth, who are essentially Al-Qaeda, and who, you know, they'll rent apartments and houses in those tribal areas from local people and engage in planning for attacks across the border into Afghanistan. And this is an area which the Pakistani government does not control. The U.S. can't send troops in there. And so in order to fight these people, they're using these unmanned drone predators. But of course, it's not a precision sort of business. And if you strike at a village, you are likely to kill locals and civilians. And the Pakistani public is starting to really, really mind. And I think in the same way that they rebelled against the president's overreaching, there's going to be increasing trouble with the Pakistani public if we go on infringing against their sovereignty.
We're going to break and then come back, and I want to talk to you about what you call the Wahhabi myth and talk about the difference between Muslim activism and Muslim radicalism, as you put it. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Our guest is Juan Cole, the internationally respected historian, blogger, professor of history at University of Michigan. His new book, Engaging the Muslim World. Stay with us.
I see y'all too. Now what? Yeah. Going down in a major way. Journalists, we're journalists too. We can strike back. Yeah. Y'all playing dirty though. Y'all playing dirty. We can get dirty. We can get dirty. No questions. I pledge resistance to the grass that hides the snakes of America, so they're watching. Now I walk with caution, more careful, put more thought to options. Right. It's the opposite of progress, Congress. Huh? From the school to the streets, we're beyond stress. But I fight for peace, that's what the problem is. War is big biz, ask an economist. They're speaking volumes, just calling anti-war and anti-American synonymous. Back in the day, I'd have gotten blacklisted just for speaking up. Hoover probably would have screamed communist. I want black and brown unity.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. Juan Cole is our guest, the internationally respected historian, blogger, and informed comment. His latest book, Engaging the Muslim World. Your second chapter, Muslim Activism, Muslim Radicalism, Telling the Two Apart.
Right. Well, you know, there's been an increasing tendency in the United States to view the Muslim Brotherhood of Egypt as somehow a terrorist organization. And it was an unindicted co-conspirator in the Holy Land Foundation case when the Bush administration came against a Muslim charity that it accused of funneling money to Hamas in Gaza. You know, an unindicted co-conspirator nothing has to be proven. That can just be put in the document by the Justice Department. And then when Steny Hoyer was in Cairo a couple years ago, he was meeting parliamentarians, and the Muslim Brotherhood has 88 seats in the lower house, which has about 444 members. So he met with the Muslim Brotherhood parliamentarian, and there was a big to-do about this in Washington. And they said, well, we don't recognize the Muslim Brotherhood, shouldn't be meeting with them, and so forth. Well, the Muslim Brotherhood made a pact with Anwar al-Sadat back in the 1970s to give up any kind of violence, to participate in civil society, and to run in these elections that Egypt has, which, you know, kind of Chicago-style elections, the party machine always wins. So the idea that we shouldn't talk to the Muslim Brotherhood and then it's accused of being the font of the radical groups and so forth. Well, it is true. Radical groups have sometimes hived off from the Muslim Brotherhood, but it's because they were dissatisfied with the Brotherhood's decision to use peaceful means to achieve its goals. So that's a very different kettle of fish, the Muslim Brotherhood, from the radical groups, the Gamal al-Islamiyya of the blind sheikh that was responsible for the first World Trade Center bombing, or the Egyptian Islamic Jihad of Ayman al-Zawahiri, which eventually joined al-Qaeda. There's a problem in the way that a lot of American pundits and politicians approach these groups, and they don't see the difference between Muslim activism and Muslim radicalism. And it's ironic because some of the best allies of the Americans in the past few years have been offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood. So Karzai's government is a government that was the Northern Alliance. One of the elements of the Northern Alliance was the Jamiat-e Islami, which was the Afghan branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. The Iraqi Islamic Party in Iraq of Tariq al-Hashimi, the vice president, which has been cooperative with the United States, is the current incarnation of the Iraqi Muslim Brotherhood. So, you know,
Where does Saudi Arabia fit into this picture?
Well, Saudi Arabia is again, a mixed bag. It is more or less an ally of the United States. It has often offered the U.S. facilities and help of various sorts. On the other hand, its state ideology of Wahhabi Islam is a very sort of idiosyncratic and rigid form of Islam. It's, by the way, not common in the rest of the Muslim world. It is a Saudi and, to some extent, a Qatari phenomenon. But the Saudi system is very repressive. You know, some people call it a gender apartheid with regard to women. They're not allowed to drive. They can become professionals, but only to service other women. The political dissent is not allowed. So it is a very authoritarian regime. And the U.S. rightly, you know, pressures it to open up, I think. But there's a difference between having an authoritarian regime, having social customs that we perhaps disapprove of, and being an enemy. And I think that distinction has to be underlined.
I wanted to ask you about the former ambassador to Saudi Arabia, Chaz Freeman. Last week, he rescinded his acceptance to head the National Intelligence Council after an intense lobbying campaign by lawmakers and lobbyists who support Israel's occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. Freeman has years of diplomatic experience, stints as the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia and assistant secretary of defense. He's also known for criticizing the decisive U.S. military, economic and diplomatic support that allows Israel to maintain the occupation. This is an excerpt of an interview that Freeman did on CNN, where he said he was targeted for his opinions.
I don't think that I've been in any respect excessively or unreasonably critical of Israel. I think I have been critical of Israeli policy. The atmosphere is such in this country now that whereas Israelis in Israel routinely criticize policies they think may prove to be suicidal for their country, those who criticize the same policies here for the same reasons are subject to political reprisal.
Juan Cole, can you respond? And what happened, the demise of Chaz Freeman?
Well, tell me about it. There's a ban on politicians in the United States being critical of Israeli policy. If you have anything serious to do with the U.S. Congress in particular, it's not allowed to be critical. And you'll have a lot of enemies who will try to shoot you down, try to get you unelected if you're elected, try to get you unappointed if you're appointed. It's a concerted effort on the part of a whole range of people. They include evangelical Christians on the right. They include right-wing Zionists in the Jewish community. It's a very odd set of alliances, but it's very effective.
Who shot Chaz Freeman down?
Well, I personally think it was congressional Democrats who, you know, he was attacked by the neoconservatives, but they're not in power. And I don't think that would have mattered very much. But when people like Chuck Schumer,
the senator from New York,
began attacking Chaz Freeman, and I think Nancy Pelosi had lunch with Freeman with General Jones and said, you know, you're going to have to defend this man. He was going to write the national intelligence estimates, or he was going to preside over the writing of the national intelligence estimates. Those national intelligence estimates have not been supportive of the Israeli line that Iran is an existential threat to Israel. They haven't been able to find any evidence of an Iranian weapons program. And so I think the Israel lobbies are very concerned to have someone like Freeman there who also wouldn't be sympathetic to the Israeli hard line.
And so who specifically would you say was most responsible in terms of the lobbies, and how upfront were they? As you write, lobbyists like to do things behind the scenes. They had to get a little in front of the scenes this time.
Well, I just think that, you know, if he's going to, he was going to be the one who had to go up to the Hill and defend the national intelligence estimates to Congress. And if there's a substantial block in Congress that is very suspicious of him, to begin with, who just wouldn't accept anything that he had to say on face value, then it is going to make trouble for the 16 intelligence agencies whose intelligence is being reported. So I think he just felt that he would be undermined.
You talk about Israel's line on Iran. What about the politics in Israel? In our headlines today, reading that Netanyahu's formed a pact with the far-right politician Avigdor Lieberman in an attempt to form a right-wing government in which Lieberman would become Israel's foreign minister. He's called for laws to require Palestinians living in Israel to swear loyalty to the Jewish state.
He's called for laws for Israelis, Israeli citizens, to have a loyalty test. These are not
singling out Israeli Arabs.
They're singling out Israeli Arabs. What I'm saying is that you said Palestinians. I just want to make clear these are not Palestinians on the West Bank who are not Israeli citizens. This is he wants a loyalty test. This is he's a racist, and this is a kind of Israeli McCarthyism, and it's unacceptable. And the Israeli government should be told it's unacceptable to have someone with the views of Avigdor Lieberman in the government. It's unacceptable. The rest of the international community have to give this message to Netanyahu. You know, when you had neo-fascists arise in places like Austria, there was a strong message sent by the European community. This is not acceptable. Same thing has to be done with
the
Israeli right.
So what effect did that have, and what effect do you think it would have here?
Well, I think that it marginalized the Austrian right, the Austrian far right, and I think that the same thing has to be done with the Israeli far right. They can't be given a pass on these things.
Finally, the title of your book, Engaging the Muslim World. How do you think the U.S. should do that, or President Obama should do that?
Well, of course, in each case, it's somewhat different. But the main thing is that the Bush administration began by talking about crusades. It invaded two Muslim countries. It rampaged around the region, causing a lot of trouble. And it's not necessary. You know, it's an easy way to nail down certain kinds of resources if that's what you want. But it made for bad relations with the Middle East in so many ways. And if the United States, as I said, you know, is going to need the Muslim world more and more in the coming decades, and the necessity is to use American soft power to engage people diplomatically. If we have a dispute with them, to find a way to resolve it without arms. And to go forward on treating people with respect and with decency and with diplomacy. And people say, well, that's a trite message. Well, it hasn't been being done. You know, it can't be trite if it's not the status quo. It would be a revolution if we did this.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Juan Cole, for joining us. Juan Cole is a historian and blogger. He's a professor of history at University of Michigan. Actually, I'll be going to Michigan this Friday night. Hope to see people in Grand Rapids. Juan Cole is also the blogger who does Informed Comment, a very popular blog online. His latest book is called Engaging the Muslim World. As we turn now to our final segment, former President George W. Bush on this St. Patrick's Day is making his first trip abroad since leaving the White House. He's expected to receive a six-figure fee to speak at a private event in the Canadian city of Calgary. Organizers say Bush will address an invite-only crowd on, quote, eight momentous years in the Oval Office and, quote, the challenges facing the world in the 21st century. Protests are underway in the week leading up to the appearance. A group calling itself People versus Bush has organized a series of events culminating in a rally outside the lecture site later today. Meanwhile, a group of Canadian lawyers are trying to block Bush's entry into their country. Lawyers Against the War says Bush should be either barred or detained for condoning the use of torture. If Canadian officials won't deny Bush entry, the lawyers say Bush should be arrested and tried for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Under Canadian law, foreign nationals who've committed committed war crimes are inadmissible to Canada. Well, the Canadian government has so far ignored the request, but we're joined now by attorney Gail Davidson, a spokesperson for Lawyers Against the War. She's joining us from Vancouver, Canada, via internet web stream. Gail Davidson, welcome to Democracy Now! What are your demands on this St. Patrick's Day?
Good morning, Amy. We've demanded, first of all, that the Canadian government bar Bush from Canada as a person suspected of torture and other war crimes and crimes against humanity. We've focused our attention on torture. And secondly, we've advised the Canadian government that if they do let Mr. Bush into Canada, once he crosses the border, that triggers Canadian legal responsibility to investigate Mr. Bush for torture, and if there are grounds, then to either prosecute him in Canada or to extradite him to another country that is willing and able to do so. Having received absolutely no response whatsoever from the Prime Minister or any of the responsible ministers that we addressed our communications to, we then made a complaint to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, asking them to advise the appropriate government official of Mr. Bush's inadmissibility to Canada and to commence an investigation into allegations of torture.
And what happened?
Absolutely nothing. We've received no response whatsoever. However, from the RCMP or the government officials, that doesn't surprise me. I'm confident we will receive a response, that we'll receive a response after Mr. Bush has come and gone. And although we haven't succeeded in educating our political leaders about what Canadian law is and what Canada's responsibility to international humanitarian law is, we are confident that eventually we will succeed. Now, although we haven't received a response from the Canadian government or the RCMP, we've received responses from all over the world. Many responses from the United States, from Canada, and from other countries saying yes, basically echoing the words of Martin Sheehan, the UN Special Rapporteur for Human Rights and Counterterrorism, who said recently, now that the witch hunt for alleged terrorists is over, it's time for the law to step in. And that seems to be the overwhelming response of many, many people.
Tomorrow, Gail Davidson, we're going to have the journalist Mark Danner on, who's gotten his hands on the Red Cross report, the International Committee of the Red Cross concluding in a secret report 2 years ago the Bush administration's treatment of prisoners constituted torture in violation of the Geneva Conventions. How does that weigh in?
That certainly is a factor that we'll be using, because once Mr. Bush leaves, we'll continue to pursue the matter legally in Canada. And I'm very glad that that 2007 ICRC report has been leaked. But I have to say, Amy, that the when we tried to prosecute Mr. Bush in November of 2004, we had the February 2004 ICRC leaked portions of that report that said exactly the same thing.
Finally, the protests that are happening today in Calgary and around Canada, can you just lay them out, Gail Davidson?
Yes. In Calgary, there's people massing there to indicate their opposition to the fact that the Canadian government has allowed Mr. Bush into Canada, incredibly, to talk about his years in the Oval Office and the important things that he did and so on. And they're doing a number of things. I understand there's a shoe collection, for instance, and I understand that by amassing shoes, they're wanting to send a double message, send a message to the Canadian government that they think it's time that the law stepped in, and also to send a message to everybody that they would like to give Mr. Bush the boot, I guess, from Canada.
Gail Davidson, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Attorney in Vancouver, speaking to us via DN video stream. Spokesperson for Lawyers Against the War on this St. Patrick's Day, calling for the arrest or the barring of President George W. Bush from entering Canada. That does it for our show. Our website is democracynow.org. I'll be in Grand Rapids, Michigan on Friday night, and then in a week, beginning the community media tour all over the country. 13th anniversary of Democracy Now! Will be in Seattle, Washington, then Washington, D.C., then Amherst, and Cambridge, Massachusetts, Montana. We'll be in Tennessee. You can go to our website, democracynow.org, for details. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Shrufo Dukkadu, Sarah Mata, Angelique Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Robbie Karen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.